Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to A Better Love. I'm your host, Dr. Greg, and it is my distinct privilege and honor to introduce my next guest, very special guest, Dr. Chris Marsh from the University of Maryland. She's a speaker, she's a teacher, a professor, I should say, but a teacher of all things sociology. Dr. Marsh, thanks so much for joining me today.
It is such a pleasure to be on your show today.
I appreciate it. You got a new book that's coming out, which my audience can pre-purchase, and we'll have all that information if you want to go check this stuff out afterwards. Yes. Before we jump into this book, can we just introduce you to my audience and like who you are and the amazing things you're doing in the world?
I can try my very best. Yeah. So I'm a sociologist and I'm a demographer, and I really try to spend some time understanding avenues into the Black middle class. Yes. And consequences of being in the Black middle class. And the reason why that's really important to me as a scholar is because I did not want to make my academic career pimping the Black poor. It was really important for me to look at all of Black America. And even though the Black middle class is a small segment of Black America, they exist. And so I, as a scholar, wanted to understand the other extreme of Black America so that we can understand all of Black America. So that's where most of my work hinges on, trying to understand avenues into the Black middle class and consequences of being in the Black middle class.
And you share this knowledge, your research with students directly at the University of Maryland. So you're teaching this stuff, right?
I'm actually teaching this stuff. This semester, I'm teaching two fantastic classes. One is on the Boondocks. Okay. I'm teaching an entire class on the Boondocks. Okay. And another one is on race, class, gender, and sports. And what are some of the dynamics around sports and how we think about racism, classism, and sexism in the sports domain?
Yeah, the sports domain. And in our previous conversation, you mentioned that you were, you know, you were with teams, you were with police departments on all of the many of the things that your research has touched on directly.
Yes. Yeah. And because, you know, I wanted to be a true scholar, I took up the sport of golf so I can understand racism. Or else I needed a hobby. I can't say which one, but I'm actually a golfer and planning to write a book on Black golfers as well.
I'm excited for that. You know what? I need to learn how to play golf eventually.
Oh, well, let's
but
just
I'll read the book anyway.
It.
I read the book anyway. Let me ask you, how does love, you know, my whole project is a love project, you know, mm-hmm. focus on helping folks understand healthy love and how it shows up in the world. That journey started with, you know, purely kind of romantic things, but how does love show up in your work, Dr. Marsh?
Oh, so love shows up in two ways in my work. One, I think the book, The Love Jones Cohort, is a love story to people that are single and living alone in the Black middle class. So love shows up in the fact that I spent this time taking the time to understand singles' lifestyles. I'm moving beyond this deficit model. I don't want to talk about, oh, you're not married, so what does this mean? Why aren't you married? Mm-hmm. What do we know about their lifestyle? So it really is a love letter or an ode to people that are single. So that's one part. The other part is that I am arguing in the book and throughout the book that singlehood and how singles think about their lifestyle, it is an aspect of Black love. And we're way too narrow in the way in which we think about Black love. A lot of people have pushed back, and I've gotten hate mail over the years saying, Dr. Marsh, you're bad for Black America because you're not supporting Black families and Black marriage. And I'm saying, oh, absolutely. To the contrary, I am definitely supporting Black love. But we have to understand that Black love may look different than the way we initially thought of it being between a husband and a wife or between two husbands or two wives. Black love can be this augmented family that don't have romantic ties, but still and yet are a very loving kind of relationship. And if I had to add one more thing to love, I would argue that one of the things the book really, really does is that I'm trying to destigmatize singlehood, and I want people to be in very loving relationships with themselves.
Yes.
Before they get into a relationship with anybody else. I'm trying to destigmatize singlehood. I want people to be very happy in their singleness. I don't want them to be in toxic relationships just for the sake of being in relationship. People don't like the word alone, so let's just call it a lovely one. You have to be a lovely one before you decide to get into a relationship with anybody else. Drop the mic. I'm out.
There it is.
I'm out. Wait, is this just audio or is it audio and video?
No, I said it's just audio. I already got shit. But you know what?
We you need to tell me. I wore my good sweater. Ain't nobody gonna see my good sweater. Am I matching my good sweater?
And you know what, the message that you have is in the book is really about specific people that were part of a study that you conducted. Yeah. So can you tell the audience about, like, who are these people? And it was a story of their lives, a qualitative study. So really in detail and depth understanding about these people's yeah. lives, 70 plus folks in your sample.
Yeah. So I interviewed over 72 people for the book, and I can't remember the actual split. I think I ended up with 62 people that we used in the book. For whatever reason, we had some people that didn't qualify because we wanted people that had never been married. So we interviewed 70 people, and of those, 70 people, like a couple of them said, I was married, but my partner is, we're not married anymore. But in my mind, they don't exist. But you were married, mm-hmm. even though you don't acknowledge them, you were married. So I really wanted to look at people who hadn't been exposed to the stimuli, that being marriage. So we had to exclude a couple of people. That left us down to 62 respondents. And of the 62 respondents, I have to be honest that women did dominate the category. And I had to make the executive decision as a scholar whether or not I wanted to make this book about Black women or whether or not I wanted to make this about Black singles and talk about both men and women using that binary. And I opted to go with both Black men and women. And I'm really happy that I did because there are some nuances that come through in the discussion in the book. And I'm glad that I included Black men into the story. The other reason why I'm glad is that I can now write another book that just looks at Black women if I want to, because yeah. I had everybody in this book. But the next book, I can really just focus on Black women if I wanted to.
But the wonderful thing in reading your book is that there are actually very distinct experiences to the Black community in general, but then gender differences, and that you actually were able to speak to because you did that. So awesome, right? Very yeah. cool. I'm glad that was like it's a key thing actually.
Right.
That sticks out to me about how, the awesomeness of your book.
Right. And there's three things that I remember about gender. There might be more in the book, but three things. And I think one directly relates to some of the work that you've done, thinking about like how friends play a central role in the lifestyle of singles. And for Black women, friends become very nurturing, where they can talk through their emotions and so on and so forth. And for Black men, you don't really see the same thing show up there. Their friendships are more like for utility purposes. Mm-hmm. And so I would argue that Black men need to build more nourishing relationship with other friends, male friends, as opposed to just putting all their baskets in their partner, all the eggs in the partner basket.
Yeah.
So that's one difference. The second difference is that there's some people that just are really happy with their singlehood and they don't want to get married. There's other people in the book that really hoping that their singlehood transitions into a partnership. But for men, it kind of felt like it was just a matter of when they're going to make that transition. And for women, it was a matter of if that transition is going to happen. And then lastly, which I thought was so fascinating, I spent almost, weeks working on this whole stigma, like who's most stigmatized as a single person. Mm-hmm. Is it women? Is it men? Is it younger? Is it older? And trying to kind of work all that out, I couldn't really land on saying it's really older Black women. There's this stigma across the board when you're single, whether or not you're a man, you're a woman, younger or older. So those are kind of the gender nuances that were fascinating to me. And had I not included men in the book, they probably wouldn't have come out the way in which they did in the book.
Yeah, no, I mean, I want to stick with this for a second. Because obviously I'm a very, European, white, Portuguese male, standard dominant sort of narratives around masculinity and all the things. Mm-hmm. And if I had not spent the years training to become a clinical psychologist, honest to God, I don't even know how I would be surviving right now. And I think about my brothers out there because I lived and served with them, almost died with them in combat. And I can tell you, we're struggling out there and I wrote about this in Psychology Today. And the thing is this, there's something powerful in your book about maybe some keys to us men in general that we have challenges with this, regardless of our ethnic racial composition. We struggle with this in general,
right.
Creating these kind of bonds and shifting a paradigm, maybe. I don't know. Right. I think we have to do it ourselves. Do you think we need to do it ourselves, the men ourselves? Are we shifting the paradigm? Black man, white man, ever, are we the ones that have to shift the paradigm? Then I want to get back to talking about single Black women specifically, because there's some other information here, nuggets that I want to get to, but. Mm-hmm.
So one of my book really is about people that are Black and middle class, but I do think that it can speak to a much broader audience. And I am admonishing men to be, they have to get comfortable with this uncomfortableness of having close relationships with men. And so I think that it is the onus really is on men to have more nurturing, intimate kind of relationships and not be scared that they're going to be thought of as being gay or soft or something like that. Because the respondents even brought that up, like, you know, they're going to think I'm gay or soft because I have like these intimate relationships with men. But I'd much rather you have these intimate relationships with men and maybe challenge your notion of masculinity as opposed to getting into these relationships and having your expecting your partner to be everything to you. That's not going to get you where you want to go. And that's going to be exhausting to both you and the partner.
Yeah. One last thing on this, because it was on my mind this morning, that it's an incredible, I love the ask, and I'm with you on the ask. And I also think it's an incredible thing, leap of faith maybe, to try this new way of existing in the world.
So one of the things that I appreciate that has happened in the book is that some people are very resolved with their singleness and they're really okay with their singleness. And I really appreciate that they don't necessarily care what people in their family and network have to say about their
amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah. Because, you know, they think about like societal pressures where you want to be married. Like, listen, I'm happy with myself. I don't care what you say about it. You're going to have to respect it and have to stand by it, especially those that are choosing to be single. Yeah, there's a certain level of resolve. And with the book, I think, you know, with more conversations about singlehood and destigmatizing singlehood, we'll see much more people resolved in their singleness.
That shift will happen.
And living very full lives. Very full lives.
I know. Dr. Marsh, I really want this experience that you found in the cohort. You know, these folks who really do, they're thriving and rocking out.
Right.
It's an amazing, like, I love this.
Right. And so like one of the things that's kind of interesting to me as a sociologist and a demographer is looking at the racial wealth gap that exists in America. And a lot of people are owning homes as single people. And also a part of that conversation is like, who are they disseminating their wealth to? So the Love Jones cohort in some ways become innovators because you think about transferring your wealth from parent to child. But you have people in the Love Jones cohort who don't have children and they don't have partners. Yeah. And they're transferring their wealth to nieces, to nephews, to godchildren, to children of friends. And they have so many more lives that they can touch. Although they didn't have a biological child, they are extending the Black middle class in very innovative kind of ways. And I appreciate them for the innovation that they bring to this conversation about wealth. And we often leave the conversation like, why aren't you married? But there's so much more to singles. And the book adds more nuance and context and texture to this demographic group.
Well, the nuance is imperative. Obviously, it's missing. And that's why you need to read this book. If you're interested in what it means to be, at least for this cohort, single and Black in America, a lot of folks are dating and they're thinking about their options.
Right.
Because they actually don't want to be single.
Right.
And probably everybody goes this way in these interviews with you. But anyway, they don't want to be single. So they're looking at their options. What data did you see in your research about the options of single Black men and women and what that looks like and what the perception of that and
One of the things that's important to me as a sociologist is that we have to contextualize the conversation and we have to understand that structural forces constrain individual dating choices for Black singles, in particular Black women. Please do not think that the onus is solely on the individual. There is a structural conversation that the book attempts to really tackle and understand. Because to leave it at the individual level, you think that you've done something wrong. But I'm saying, we gotta unpack that and broaden the lens and talk about how structure constrains our individual choices. And we don't always have that conversation.
No.
And so that's one of the things that the book really does a really great job of doing.
Oh, I appreciate it in general. And I think there's tons of pressure in the narrative about how love unfolds in our lives that puts the onus on us in our individual characteristics. I thought about you as a sociologist, when I first decided to study psychology, I actually got a bachelor's in social psychology because of that, the power of that intersection between our individual psychologies and these larger constraints. So what are the constraints? What did you find? What are some of the nuances there for your cohort?
Right. So we have to think about like racism, how racism in social institution plays out, how gendered racism, how being a Black woman in particular plays out in how you think about your dating choices. And those are things that we don't necessarily talk about. And the book really does kind of try to talk about that. I talk about like wage differences. I talk about like health outcomes being middle class and how that varies, like being Black and middle class, being a Black woman. So I try to kind of point to different kind of like aspects of social institutions and how they play out and how they feed directly into our constraints.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the pieces that stands out to me.
Education too, I think.
Education as well. Yeah, of course. Actually, that was one of the things. Yeah, that was one of the points that you made in the book. At least the cohort came up with, and some of their conversations about options. Mm-hmm. I think if I remember correctly, that the women were generally saying that they were wanting that they had achieved some level of higher education, social economic status, et cetera, and their options for the kind of men that they wanted to date weren't there. Did I read that correctly?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So there's two things that we're kind of unpacking as sociologists. And one is this kind of notion about the sex ratio imbalance. There aren't enough Black men to professional Black women. So it's just purely a sex ratio imbalance. And that is structural. And that feeds into your individual choices. There's also this notion called educational homogamy. And what that means is that, for example, if I have a PhD, I would like to marry somebody who has a PhD, an MD, or something like that. You just don't have people that are of your same class status if Black women want to marry somebody of a different educational level than them. Yes. They also have to take into consideration how interracial dating plays into this entire conversation as well. So I try to tackle different areas and how it really constrains our choices, and we just don't even realize it. And we think that we're individually doing something wrong. No, there are structural forces that contextualize the conversation. So I'm not going to allow you to kind of like demean yourself or put yourself down without trying to understand the context, which we are trying to navigate through.
Obviously, if we're in the U.S. Senate right now, in the U.S. Congress voting on legislation to protect the idea of interracial marriage, that there are obvious forces, right, that are impinging on all of us, but definitely impacting the options that Black Americans have in terms of their dating. If they're just rocking out being single, that's cool too.
Right. So if you're embracing your singlehood and you're not interested in dating, I'm cool with that. I'm so cool with that. If you want to transition from single to partnered or anything, I'm cool with that too. I don't care if you're single by choice or by circumstance. Yeah. But what I do want you to understand is that because you are single, in some ways it can be an oppressive identity that exists in America that permeates almost every social institution. We are definitely a society that caters to a marriage market. Want you to be married, we want you to be partnered. Single, there are definitely spaces where it's not accepted, it's not welcomed. And I think about taxes as a really great example where people are oppressed in some ways because they are single. That's more of a that's very structural. If we think of a slightly more benign example, think about like phone plans and you're trying to get the family plan. I'm a family of one. Can I get a family plan?
Yeah. No.
I want to go on vacation. I was like, I want to do a single occupancy versus dual occupancy. I'm pay twice as much for single occupancy. So it permeates about every social institution. There's some data that suggests that married folks make more money than single folks. So, it permeates every social institution. So we have to have a conversation about it. So one of the things that I am mildly nervous about, and one of the arguments that I make in the book, and I'm curious to know how people embrace the argument. If we think about this notion in sociology about intersectionality, this is where you have like these multiple oppressive identities, like your race, your gender, and your class. These are multiple oppressive identities that shape kind of some of the reasons why we're seeing a rise in singlehood among Black folks, Black women in particular. I am arguing That's a pretty easy, solid argument. I'm also arguing when we think about the matrix of domination, it should be race, class, gender, and singlehood.
Mm-hmm. So there's a weight there's a weight to those variables. In other words,
that's the question. Should they be weighted equally or should they not be weighted equally?
Well, and your argument is they should be weighted differently.
I'm arguing that they need to be taken all need to be taken into consideration.
Understood. Yeah.
If I wasn't writing the book, I would probably challenge that argument.
Yeah. Okay.
But I do think that it sparks the conversation and a discussion. You don't have to agree with me, but let's have the conversation. Are we so driven by being partnered and married that we don't even realize how being single is stigmatized in almost every social institution?
The answer is yes. We're confused. You know what I mean? In general, right. I think it's important.
I think it's a beautiful thing. Yeah. I am celebrating Black love. I am celebrating Black marriage. I am celebrating all of that, but I'm not celebrating at the expense of who you are and your dignity and self-worth.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a freedom in that, and being able to make a choice about who you love from that place.
Yes. Yes.
Please. Yeah. I hope everyone who's listening to this loves from that place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
gosh, I'd like to find someone who can love me that way. I mean, I don't know. I mean, listen, there's the dating scene is no joke for those of us who are not going to thrive as single. Dr. Marsh, I am not one of those men who are going to thrive as a single man. I'm so caught up in the paradigm, the old paradigm.
But that's so dangerous. That is so dangerous.
I don't want to change.
Okay. Well, you do you. So you're going to have about three or four divorces you're going to maybe possibly go through, or else you're just going to be absolutely miserable. Now, one of the things I do want to highlight, I think it's chapter 9 or 10, where it talks about the mental and physical health. Yes. And there are some people who have talked about being lonely and single single. Yeah. But one of the things that we do know, it's not this chronic kind of loneliness. It's kind of like this situational loneliness where they might be a little bit lonely around the holidays. They might be a little bit lonely when they have like a major disaster that happens like in their lives. Mm-hmm. But this is where, again, family and friends become central cast in the movie of those that are single and living alone. So make sure that you have a friendship network that you can draw from, because there might be times where you might find yourself a little lonely. But in that same breath, people often talk about their freedom and how they really appreciate their freedom. They don't have to worry about asking somebody if they should buy another piece of property or where they should live. So there's some trade-offs.
There are trade-offs. There's beautiful elements to both things. If you are in the middle class, like if you do have, you know, the options we're talking about and all the things and whatever it is, you know what I mean? All the things, powerful stuff. What, any other messages to our audience about just healthy love or anything else from your book that you want to make sure that they're thinking about?
So the healthy love is really, really, really important. Self-care is absolutely important. I would hope that you would make yourself happy, healthy, and whole as an individual before you decide to partner with anybody else, and understand that you can have really positive, nurturing relationships with people that aren't necessarily your romantic partner. Yeah. We underestimate those and we overestimate the romantic partners, but we don't put a lot of effort and energy into like our friendships. For example, I was talking to someone just the other day about how you have all of these marriage family therapists, and you can talk about your marriage when there's problems with your marriage, but we don't have a lot of therapy for friends and friendships. And I think we really do undervalue friendships, and friendships are key in singlehood. So I would hope that we spend more time thinking about cultivating our friendships as opposed to trying to find that person.
Mm-hmm. And community, maybe faith community or other kind of community folks to be connected to.
Yeah.
Let's strive to do that, especially men like me. If you're listening, men, this is what we need to do.
Right. And just because you may live in the house by yourself does not mean that you're alone. You do have a network that's around you, and that's indicative of the love that we're really talking about. And we need to just be more embracing of a different kind of like love. And it just doesn't have to look that one kind of normative understanding of like marriage.
Because you miss out. I love it. Let's break out of the paradigm. Let's, you know, give ourselves an opportunity to see love in all its forms. And Dr. Marsh, one of those is friendship. I hope to be your friend for a very long time.
Absolutely.
I'm glad to have met you. And yes. And I'm so grateful for you to come on the show. If you want to find your stuff, where should people go?
There's a couple different places you can go. The best place to go at this point, where you can keep up with what I'm doing, where I'm going to be, you know, having book talks and discussions, would be my website. And that is Dr. Chris Marsh, DrKrisMarsh.com. You can pre-order the book right there. If you go to my events calendar, you can see what I'm up to over the next couple of months. And hopefully I'll meet you somewhere across the country talking about people that are single and living alone, Black middle class, and thriving.
Thriving, ladies and gentlemen, yes. Thriving. You also want to catch Dr. Marsh on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
All of my social media is the same ID, Dr. Chris Marsh, DrKrisMarsh. You can catch me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. I haven't gotten to TikTok yet.
It could be dangerous. It could be dangerous. But I think you should. I think you should be everywhere. I think your message needs to be heard in every corner of the world, and I hope it is. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Chris Marsh here at A Better Love Project. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you. I hope you have an amazing holiday, and love each other fiercely. Peace. Yes.